we'll open up the Q&A session.
Thank you. You're ready to take questions, sir?
Yes. Operator, do you have any questions from those on the remote facilities?
Thank you, sir. Please press star 1 at this time if you have a question. If at any time you wish to cancel your question, please press the pound sign. There will be a brief pause while participants register for questions. Thank you for your patience. We have a question from Larry Schwartz. Please go ahead, sir.
Hi. Yes, Larry Schwartz, Energy Probe. I guess I have one general question, one more specific one. I must say I enjoyed the report. One of the alleged advantages of incentive regulation is the avoidance of or the much decreased need to allocate costs, as we see in the conventional cost of service. And yet, in reading your report, I didn't get the impression that that was a strong benefit from your point of view, and also perhaps raised very significant cost allocation issues of its own. Is there a benefit on balance, do you think, in this regard?
Well, Bob is more of an expert in this than I, but I think that one of the benefits of using one of these mechanisms is not just that we don't have to look at costs because, as I said, with either of N1 or N2, there are going to be some fairly significant data requirements. There are going to be some fairly significant discussions in a regulatory forum. And so, it, as you say, it may not be completely clear that the administrative costs of setting up these regimes is lower than the administrative costs of a cost of service regime. But I don't think that's a big difference between those and other incentive mechanisms. The big difference to me is that you don't bear it every year. The idea is that you set this up and let it run. That's why you need off-ramps, because you run this regime for 3 or 4 years and once you set it up. So you don't have to be going to cost of service every year. Bob, do you have any further comments on the relative administrative costs here of an incentive of our recommended incentive mechanisms versus a cost of service mechanism?
No, I don't have much to add to that. I mean, you would obviously need to allocate costs to establish the initial prices. But beyond that, as in cost of service regulation, if they stay in place for a number of years, you don't have to allocate costs there either. So I'm not sure there may be some modest advantage of incentive regulation, but I'm not sure it's that significant, as long as you're talking about fairly broad-based mechanisms and not targeted mechanisms where, you know, there are many more measurement challenges that are introduced.
All right. If I have a moment, can I ask a second question? It relates to page 25 of your report, and I just wasn't sure I understood the point you were making. There's a paragraph that begins, with respect to O&M costs, all of the Niagara plants are regulated and are operated as a group. It is possible directly to assign many O&M costs to this group. The R.H. Saunders station is located.
Larry, could you speak up, please?
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. There was just something on page 25 of the Power Advisory Report that I wondered if the authors could clarify. It's the paragraph that begins, with respect to O&M costs, all of the Niagara plants are regulated and are operated as a group. And I wasn't sure I understood the point of that paragraph.
Yeah, I don't see the specific paragraph, but our understanding is that the Niagara plants, as distinct from the Saunders plant, were operated as a group, and that you would be able to have an incentive mechanism that just looked at O&M for the group as an entire group. It wouldn't make sense to focus on any individual asset within that group, as there may be, you'd want to provide OPG with the ability to continue to operate and take advantage of synergies that exist by operating them as a group. You wouldn't want to do anything in the incentive mechanism that took away that flexibility. That was the main point of that.
Yes. Well, then what is the point about R.H. Saunders? Is the problem there that because it's the only regulated part of the St. Lawrence plant group that it would have to be allocated all of the costs of the group?
Well, no, you would have to go through an allocation process to allocate some costs between a regulated asset and the remainder of those unregulated hydro facilities. So it would introduce just an extra step and potential source of controversy if there were an incentive mechanism.
I understand. Thank you very much.
Okay, we'll open the floor here in the North hearing room.
Julie Gervin, Consumers Council of Canada. Mitch, can you just explain to me from a practical perspective how N2 would work? It's not completely clear to me.
I think that N2 was going to require working it out through the regulatory process, through the process of discussion between OPG, the board, and the interveners. To take an example, if we were to look at N2, if we were to think of something like the forced loss rate, say if you said that the forced loss rate at Pickering is now, I don't remember the numbers, but let's say it's at 20%, and the benchmarking level would be, say, 10%. You can, from knowing what the forced loss rate is, you can compute what the implications are for the total output of Pickering. So if you say, okay, we're going to say that the incentive levels for the forced loss rate should be 18% in the first year of the IRM, 16% in the second year, 14% in the third year, and 12% in the fourth year. We're going to improve the forced loss rate at Pickering by 2% per year. And you could set that for the plant as a whole or set it up by units, however you wanted to do that, and compute from those reductions in the forced loss rate what the implications would be, that is, how much let more generation you would get out of the plant. We know what the price is going to be because that got set. And so what we say from that is, sorry, we don't know what the price is going to be. We know what the generation is going to be. We know what the revenue requirement is in each of those 4 years. And so when we go to decide the price for each of those 4 years, we take the revenue requirement. We aren't influencing the revenue requirement by this piece of N2. We divide it by a larger number in each case because we're getting more output from Pickering. And so the price would be forced down in each of those years based on an assumption that the forced loss rate at Pickering would be going down. And then you would have similar kinds of discussions about expenditure items.
Okay, so you'd have a whole host of metrics that you're talking about.
However many you wanted, yes.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
And I think if you're familiar with the concept of the forward test here, where you have those discussions both with respect to the numerator and the denominator, this would be akin to sort of a multi-year forward test year. It'd be a forward test year one, forward test year two, forward test year three, and you'd be building in incentive efficiency improvements into the design of the rates for years, even beyond year one.
Well, sort of really cost of service with efficiency improvements assumed in the cost of service.
Right, that's one way to look at it.
Okay, thanks.
Another question from the floor?
Yeah, Norm Rubin for Energy Probe. Mitch, when I saw your unintended consequences on the nuclear chart, I kind of thought the word safety might pop up there, that one of your unintended consequences would be that pressure on cost reduction or output increase might have a perverse effect on safety margins. And I say this as one who loves incentives and incentive rate mechanisms, but gets nervous when we start squeezing the nuclear people too hard, as dearly as I would love to squeeze them too hard. And it just occurs to me that if we looked at a similar report for improving the efficiency of the Tokyo Electric Power Company from 2 years ago, we might recoil in horror at the omissions. And we might wish that we had an incentive structure that would give them free money to move the diesel fuel tanks up the hill or to build a higher seawall. And I just wonder, can you help me get comfort in tightening the screws on OPG nuclear to lower their costs and improve their output without wondering whether we will be increasing the perverse incentives that we know the rest of the system has, like the fact that we know if there are off-site consequences for a nuclear accident, we've given them all the incentive there by saying it's not their fault, they don't have to pay. We know they have one shareholder who can go to taxpayers to bail out any overruns they have on a really bad day. In other words, the larger incentive scheme seems to be designed by the devil, and adding something here that seems to make sense out of context, assuming that the country's in the very best of hands and that regulation is perfect, you know, just doesn't quite seem to cut it for me. Can you give me comfort?
I'm not a nuclear engineer. I can't give you comfort on the lines of, do we have good engineering and good safety approaches? And I can say, as we did in the report, basically, I have to agree, we kind of skated over that issue by saying that the CNSC regulations continue to apply. I think that, and we would also hope and expect that OPG itself would continue to put treat safety as a priority and would not want to skimp on safety in order to meet these targets. And we said, taking our example, we looked at saying, what are the kinds of objectives that OPG itself said it could meet? And we assumed that those would not jeopardize safety. The issue you raise is a difficult one for everybody. I remember, I go back a while, as you know, and I remember my old boss, Lorne McConnell, when told that he had to reduce his what is probably by then a couple hundred million dollar or something like that operating budget by, $5 million or something, said, okay, well, I'm going to take away the safety chain in front of a dam on the river in Peterborough, and when the canoeist goes over the falls, it's your fault. So we would hope that OPG would not take that approach, but those kinds of things those kinds of ideas exist within that organization. Well, did exist within the organization. I think they don't anymore, but I can't give you comfort in the sense that you would expect that the incentives would be carefully designed in cooperation with OPG and with essentially not necessarily always the consent, but with the cooperation of OPG in determining how the incentives are to work. You would expect that OPG would continue to operate with safety as a goal, especially in regard to its nuclear plants. Do we think that those operations are perfect? Have there been accidents? Of course there have. And I don't think anybody else can give you complete comfort that such an accident can never happen, but we rely both on the regulators and on OPG and the process.
I could just add to that. I think what we're talking about here is optimization subject to an absolute. There is a safety regulator. The safety regulator is different from the economic regulator for a reason, and the optimization that will take place here will be subject to an imperative. The safety will be an imperative or should be an imperative, and it's the obligation of OPG's board and management to make sure there's no confusion about that point. And then it's the obligation of OPG when it comes before the economic regulator to clearly communicate what it means to meet its safety obligation in terms of investments and costs and so forth. And those should be recoverable. So that that would be the way I would see it working.
Do you have a follow-up, Norm?
If I can do a quick supplementary, I think those things make sense if there's a bright line somewhere that says as long as the regulator is happy, everything is perfect, and it's okay to give incentives to the rank and file to, say, maximize output, and it's okay to give incentives to the rank and file to, say, if you can, cut some costs. But if you see safety as a constant trade-off where you can always spend more money, you can always be a little quicker on the hair trigger to shut down if you're not sure that everything is okay, if you see it the way I think it is in the real world, then the question is, can you design good top-level incentives that translate down to the bottom level without, in fact, undermining the safety culture that says, when in doubt, shut down the plant and lose the output for 36 hours? That costs a bundle. And, you know, people have been fired over it in the history of the world, and they mustn't be because it's the prudent thing to do. Yep. And then you come in and tighten the screws. Anyway, I'm not sure there's an answer to the question.
That's a great way to express it as well. That's a great point. Well expressed.
I'm going to go offline and see if there are any questions from those that are remotely here. Operator, do you have any other questions?
Yes, we do. We have a question from David Bosch. Please go ahead.
Hi, guys. I wanted to get a little more clarification on what you're proposing for an add-on incentive or a tweak to deal with the Darlington Renewal Project. In your report, I think it's page 61, you seem to give a couple of alternatives. It's not clear to me how they blend with the larger incentive. One is to say, let's get your projection and hold you to it somehow, or make you, you know, penalize you if you don't perform to it. And the other is to mirror terms of the that are in the major contracts. And that one confused me. It seemed to me it may be a little bit cart before the horse. It struck me that you'd want to encourage terms in your contract with major vendors that force them to take on risk, so that, because they're the ones who are having to perform in the main. I'm not sure what you, it wasn't clear to me from your slides what you're recommending. It seemed to me you were recommending the latter, but backwards, that you were saying let the incentive mechanism to OPG reflect what terms they've negotiated with their major vendors, which strikes me as letting everybody off the hook.
Are we looking at each other?
That's for you, Mitch, I think, being nuclear.
Great. The you know, I'm sort of going back in history and I'm trying to remember when we wrote this paragraph, but I think my sense is that the contracts with the vendors were already in place, so we were dealing with that situation in terms of the cart being before the horse. Ideally, you'd like to give the incentives to the buyer and then have them pursue shifting some of that risk and aligning those incentives with the vendors. But I think in this case, we might have been driven by the fact that we understood that the vendor contracts already existed.
So what we're really saying is the cart's that the horse is out of the gate.
That was our impression, but I would certainly...
Yeah, I guess that's a factual question which would be important for us to understand in this discussion, which is to what extent are those contracts in place, you know, for the duration?
Is that your follow-up, David?
Yeah, I guess that's just I'll leave that out there as a thought for folks, and we can try to make that, put that into some written submission so it doesn't get lost.
Okay, thank you. From the floor, Jay?
I just want to follow up on, Jay Shepherd, the School Energy Coalition. I just want to follow up on what Julie was talking about.
your report correctly points out that IRM works best if the future is similar to the past. And we know, at least, and I think you're proposing that we assume in nuclear, at least, that the future not be the same as the past, that there be changes in production, expected changes in production, changes in cost efficiencies, and, of course, we know some very significant capital spending, lumpy capital spending is coming in. And that tells me that IRM isn't the right answer. And, in fact, it looks like your N2 is multi-year cost of service. I couldn't distinguish between what you proposed and multi-year cost of service. Can you help me understand how they're different, if they are?
You can call it what you like. The idea of... to me, one of the essences of an incentive mechanism is that year-to-year cost changes are divorced, year-to-year price changes are divorced from year-to-year actual cost changes. And whereas in a cost of service environment, year-to-year price changes depend on year-to-year cost changes. As ex post or as projected on the year to year on the test, they depend on the expected cost changes in the test year. And you're right that in this case, we're saying that the year to year price changes will depend on the year to year cost changes in the test year, but that these expected cost changes will be based on essentially not on business as usual, not on a simple extrapolation of existing performance, but rather on a significant improvement in existing performance.
All right. So my follow-up then is with respect to hydroelectric, you've proposed what it appears to be a price cap mechanism, and yet we know that it's more than 50% of the cost, the annual revenue requirement is driven by the capital. And that cost is going down, of course, because the existing capital is going down. But they're going to add a big lump, 40% addition to their rate base over the next year. And their controllable costs are less than 20% of their total. And so I'm trying to understand how a price cap works in that environment. That looks to me like a situation which is exactly where you want multi-year cost of service. Because you know that there's going to be some costs going down and some big lumps coming in that you have to deal with. And I don't understand why you'd be proposing a price cap in that environment. I didn't get it.
Yeah, I think we were thinking that the price cap would make sense if you also had one on the nuclear side for symmetry, but you would have to take the Niagara Tunnel project out of that equation and treat it in some different way.
I understand, but then you have also the 50% of revenue requirement right now that's going down every year because the existing capital is being depreciated. So that part I don't understand how you could have a price cap unless it was just on OM&A, in which case it wouldn't be a price cap anymore.
Right. No, that makes sense.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Another question from the floor? Yes?
This is Travis Allen, counsel for the Retail Council of Canada. I wanted to go back to David Bosch's question about the DRP. So one of the big concerns that we often hear from our members, retailers large and small, is that they're very concerned about the way that these large capital projects are financed and the accuracy of the estimates vis-a-vis the end cost. And that's something you raised also in your report, of course, a history of issues with CANDU refurbishments and running over cost. So I just wanted to confirm that do you think that the best way to ensure accuracy of these types of projections is to make the shareholder basically pay if the costs get overrun? And I recognize that you said there might be issues with the contracts being in place here, but I think this could also relate to other large capital investitures.
I think the fact that whether you have an IRM or a cost of service model, you still have the opportunity for prudence reviews. So in that case, you would have for a major project like that, a prudence review would be appropriate. And I think we stated that in the report as well.
Right. Well, that was what I was wondering is, how does the prudence review interact with some sort of incentive mechanism? Would both of them occur? Because I thought I read in here that you also talked about some sort of incentive if the project cost went over.
Right. We were not... I haven't really thought through how they would work together. But certainly if you had built in an incentive to try to get at costs, and there were still issues that required some incremental penalty through a prudence review, you would have to design it so there was no double counting. You weren't penalizing the company twice, in a sense. But I hadn't thought through the mechanics of that, to be honest.
From the floor.
Good morning. It's Richard Stevenson from the Power Workers Union. If I'm the regulator, why wouldn't I be very concerned about the absence of any successful precedent out there? Leave aside, in fact, the absence of any precedent at all, successful or unsuccessful. I mean, shouldn't I feel cautious from the perspective of a probability of success and the avoidance of adverse unintended outcomes, where I cannot look out into the field and see that this has ever been done anywhere, successfully or otherwise?
Yeah, and I think that's why you see incentive mechanisms, first of all, have fairly, lots of belts and suspenders. When they're first, to the extent that the stakeholders have a lot of similar concerns, and the companies do as well in some cases, you tend to see a lot of belt and suspenders through the off-ramps, exogenous factors, earnings sharing, and so forth. That's one of the reasons why you see those things. And you also see, so there's there can be an opportunity to reopen, and a lot of times people are most concerned with extraordinary over or under earnings. That seems to be one of the bigger concerns in terms of uncertainty about the future. And the earnings sharing mechanism can get to those issues. But you also see regulators being cautious to adopt a particularly long term for the plan the first time around. So you might see a 3-year term the first time an incentive mechanism is adopted, and hesitancy to go much beyond that. I think a shorter than 3-year term may take away some of the ability of the utility to do some things that provide longer term efficiencies. So you don't want a term that's too short. But from what I've seen, 3 years seems to be a reasonable starting point where you have those types of concerns.
A little follow-up on that. Just, I didn't see in the report any, at least explicit, risk-benefit analysis of, really frankly, any of the alternatives vis-a-vis the status quo. And there seems to be an implicit acceptance that at least one or some combination of the alternatives are better than the status quo. But I didn't see, am I wrong about that?
No, I mean, we did not do a rigorous assessment of the alternatives. We did, we identified and performed, a fairly high-level assessment, but, our report was intended to begin the discussion, I think, did not go certainly as far as you might have wished in that respect.
Okay, we'll ask the operator any offline questions.
Certainly. Please press star 1 at this time if you have a question. There are no questions registered at this time, sir.
Thank you, operator. Floor open for questions.
Yeah, I just, Norm Rubin again, I just got a thought. Would it be a friendly amendment to N2 2, or does it get us into N3 or something else, to add, for example, one or two of Scott Madden's safety benchmarks as something that gets rewarded or punished depending on whether it improves or erodes?
It does get to N3, but it doesn't smoothly get to N2. That is, the idea of N2 is that the incentive objectives all can come down to something that goes into the price, whereas the Scott Madden safety benchmarks don't. And so that would be an appropriate way to put an N3 addition onto N2, and that's a good thought, because I think it does do that. So yeah, I agree. And I would hope it would give you and others some comfort.
Okay, one more question from the floor.
Randy Pugh from Ontario Power Generation. I think your answer just confused me, so maybe I want to get a better understanding of N2 and N3. I thought N3 was really N2 started earlier. So instead of – did I get that right?
Yeah, I think you did, and I think I got sorry, I shouldn't be doing this. I should be going through my it's N4. Norm, you meant N4, I think. Right? Yeah, we meant N4, not N4.
In doing N2, I got the impression like the Scott Madden benchmarking report was used to develop targeted incentives, targeted performance that's built into the revenue requirements that is allowed, approved or assessed and approved by the regulator. So those performance targets, we can discuss what those performance targets are. They could include safety. They could include other metrics that you want to, in your value proposition for generation, include. So I don't know if I'm struggling with N4 versus N2 and N3, frankly.
Well, again, the idea of N4 was, like other incentive mechanisms, to set up a revenue requirement in advance, to set up a price in advance over the period term of the regime that doesn't depend on the actual performance during that period, but rather depends on anticipated performance during that period. In this case, we're setting it relative to certain specific targets rather than some overall measure, because that seems to suit better both the difficulty of setting an overall performance target and the specific circumstances of OPG nuclear. The N4 idea is maybe there are some additional criteria that you'd like to be able to be ensure you meet, like safety, that don't readily translate into something that would affect either the numerator or the denominator of the price calculation, that is either the revenue requirement or the output. So safety doesn't directly affect either of those, and you can build it in, but it would require some way to set safety targets, some way to measure how well those safety targets are being met, and then some compensation that is outside that direct price-setting mechanism that would provide the incentive for achieving those safety targets. And would presumably, again, those safety targets would have to be in addition to the constraints set by the safety regulator, by the CNSC.
So if I'm following up what you have on page 24 of your slide then, I think what you've told me is this. You've discussed option N4 at the top here.
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying it can be applied to options 1 or 3? Are you saying it can be applied to options 1, 2, and 3?
Yeah, I think it can be applied to options 1, 2, and 3. When I wrote that, I was thinking that it would be other things that could affect the revenue or output. But if really it does take other aspects of service quality, and that would be safety. And yes, I think it could be applied to N1, 2, or 3. Thank you.
Thank you. You've clarified that for me. Can I ask one tiny clarification point? It's in your executive summary. And it talks about this assessment will consider the prospect that specific IRM options will promote more efficient investments. I'm just trying to figure out what that is. Is this we've done an assessment on a benefit-to-cost basis. It's an approved project, and OPG has assessed whether they bring it on time and within budget? Or is it? Or are you envisioning something different? Because I didn't see that concept in the executive summary elaborated on in the report.
Bob has the report in front of him. Let me just see if I can get my cup.
Well, I'm just trying to figure out what's meant by three words, more efficient investments. What does that mean?
I don't think it refers to a specific item as much as the notion that when you make your investment, when OPG makes their investments, on the hydro side, they're focused on expanding capacity that is available when it is needed, and that you're doing what you currently do now, but making sure that you have those short-term and long-term objectives in mind, so that you're making investments that improve efficiency while also keeping your eye on the longer-term objectives. So it wasn't any specific. It was a fairly general comment, not a specific mechanism.
Okay, that concludes the Q&A of this session. I remind all those present and online that we also have scheduled for a general discussion later in the afternoon. If you look at the agenda, I think it's 3:40 to 4:30, and then there's overflow. So there's plenty of time if you can stay awake. So now we'll move to the next presentation by London Economics, A.J. Goulding and Julia Freyer. And you can do it however you like, and it may be up here because you can see faces, but it'll still be the same on all the screens. So
Rusty, does that mean you didn't believe me when I said we found this exciting?
No comment.